This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharyson, the editor-in-chief over at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 152 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the NumberFire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. Since I won't have time to do an auction draft strategy podcast this year, I thought it might be helpful to spend a minute talking about my approach before we get into the questions for this week's mailbag. I got an email from Phil a week and a half ago that said, "Hey JJ, been doing some work with auction mock drafts for the last couple of weeks, and I was wondering if you were going to cover auction strategy in a podcast this year." Well, clearly I'm not. I use the stars and scrub strategy overall, but I'm having trouble deciding what to do between the actual stars portion and the scrubs portion. After grabbing a couple of top tier players, do you typically grab one second tier player, someone like Dalvin Cook, Saquon Barkley, or Keenan Allen, around $40 to $50? Or do you grab a couple of mid-tier players like T.Y. Hilton, Adam Thielen, or Christian McCaffrey around $20 to $30? Okay, so when I talk stars and scrubs, I don't just mean that you should get David Johnson and Le'Veon Bell on your squad. I mean that you should be doing your best to get more early round picks or selections than you typically would in a snake draft. Because there's historically been a drop-off in production once you hit rounds 4, 5, and 6. And the difference between a typical 10th rounder in a snake draft and someone in the 6th or 7th round is not overly significant. This year specifically, we've got a pretty deep pool of players. That makes it a little bit easier to not absolutely have to spend on someone like Todd Gurley, but maybe get a pair of backs like Leonard Fournette and Dalvin Cook or Kareem Hunt and Melvin Gordon. And then with any savings you might get in going that route versus getting two of the stud backs, you can then spend on a typical later second rounder. But the bottom line with auction drafts will always come down to tiers. You should absolutely tier your rankings and utilize them while you're drafting. It allows you to find discounts as the draft goes on. If you know that Christian McCaffrey is in the same tier as someone like Devontae Freeman, let's say, and you see Devontae Freeman go for $40, then you should expect to pay around that much money for Christian McCaffrey. And then if you pay far less, then you know that you're gaining some value. I also got a question from Twitter from @ZEgner that said, "How do you change your draft strategy in an auction format? What advantages can be exploited?" Now, a lot of this is covered on episode 37 of the Late Round Podcast. It's an evergreen episode that I did last year. But don't overthink things. It's not like Randall Cobb is more valuable in an auction draft than a snake draft. He's the same player accumulating the same number of fantasy points. The big thing with auctions is that you're not forced to make selections. You can extract more value when you develop your tiers. That's why tiers are so important for auctions specifically. So hopefully that helps you out a bit. I've been getting a lot of auction questions, so I at least wanted to address that at some point this offseason. Now before we get into more mailbag questions, I wanted to remind you guys about NumberFire Premium. With NumberFire's customizable draft kit, you can just enter your league settings and get a custom draft board tailored to you. Plus, with NumberFire Premium, you get risk profiles, auction values, tier sheets, expert rankings, and so much more. That doesn't even include the award-winning DFS tools, gambling picks, and premium content that also come with NumberFire Premium. First-time users can use promo code CHAMPION at checkout and get their first month of premium for just $9.99. That's promo code CHAMPION. Visit numberfire.com/premium for more details. Now let's dig into these questions. This first question is from Twitter from @Dylan_HFF. If you know most of your league will waste one of their bench spots with a second quarterback, does that change how you target quarterbacks in the draft? As I always say, you have to adjust to how things are going and moving in your draft. But you should do it on the fly, as in, don't just get Carson Wentz early because you're assuming everyone's going to roster multiple quarterbacks. Don't do anything crazy. But if I know that every single quarterback will be rostered, hypothetically of course, then yes, I'll change the way that I draft quarterbacks. I'll more than likely look for a guy who can provide a decent floor and then perhaps also draft a second quarterback who's more of a ceiling player. But I'm still not going to spend a lot at the position when the format calls for just one quarterback to be started. And if it's most of my league rostering two quarterbacks, I still more than likely will just roster one. I mean, realistically, you're looking at maybe 20 quarterbacks rostered in a 12-team league if most teams are rostering two quarterbacks. That still leaves room for streaming. But if you'd be nervous about streaming those types of quarterbacks, just get a backup like everyone else is. Always adjust. Always, always adjust. This next one says, "Hey JJ, thanks again for the great, quick, free content. Thanks. How do you adjust your draft strategy for softer leagues as opposed to industry leagues? I'm not being arrogant and underestimating my league mates, but Tom Brady and Matt Ryan went 1.1 and 1.3 in last year's draft. Thanks again, Matt. Yeah, so I think I've mentioned this before, but when I know that my league mates aren't very knowledgeable, I then also know that one, it'll be easier to extract value in the draft, and two, the waiver wire will probably also be easier to navigate during the season. So in that case, I may be more inclined to go with someone like Rob Gronkowski in the second round to get the tight end advantage, even though in most leagues I'm a late round tight end drafter. I may take more risks early on with individual players too, knowing that I can make up for those risks with value picks later on, and even on the waiver wire. So that's generally how I would approach an easier league. This next one's an email. It says, "Hey JJ, the number fire material that you and your colleagues put out are second to none, and the only time on your podcast where there isn't valuable fantasy advice is the pause before you say, thanks for tuning in. Could you explain on your analysis on positive and negative game scripts and the correlation to fantasy scoring? It seems logical to target players on good offenses, but productive players that should get heavy touches could be on bad offenses. What's the overall impact? Thanks, Derek from Iowa." Productive players do come from bad offenses too, yes, but it's all about probability. When I say target players in good offenses, I'm saying that you're going to have a higher likelihood that those players succeed just given their environment. I mean, it's no different than anything else that you do in life. If you're in a crappy environment, it may be more difficult to get a job. It might be tougher to just be healthy. Your environment matters. But just to give you an example of this, I wrote this up in an article on players to avoid in fantasy football, but of the top 50 running back seasons over the last 5 years, the average number of touchdowns scored in those running backs' respective offenses has been 42.1. So a random top 10 running back, his offense scored over 42 touchdowns in that season where he was an RB1. The average number of touchdowns scored by an NFL offense during this time was 36.9. So you're looking at a difference of almost 6 touchdowns, which is actually pretty significant. And then if you listen back to my podcast on breakout running backs and receivers, the whole target players and good offenses thing is also mentioned on both of those shows. And what that means is, generally speaking, fantasy owners are undervaluing situation. That's why you can get these breakout players from good offenses late in your fantasy drafts. The positive game script thing makes sense intuitively too. When a team's in a positive game script, that means they did something to get into that script. And when I say did something, I mean score points. And if they scored points, then they're scoring fantasy points. This is why I can't stand the notion of garbage time in fantasy football and fantasy football analysis. Because in order to reach garbage time, you need to have put up a garbage performance. It's not always on the offense, but the chances that the offense had something to do with a negative game script is still fairly high. You know, if a quarterback is in garbage time in the fourth quarter, it's probably because that quarterback didn't play well through the first three quarters of the game. I'm not saying that you're feeling this way, Derek, but when fantasy analysts like myself say to do things like target players and good offenses, we're not making the assumption that good players can't come from bad offenses. They absolutely can. We're always, or I'm always, talking in terms of probability because that's what this game is. That's what fantasy football is. It's a game of probability. This next question says, "Hey JJ, this is Trevor from Phoenix. I'm in two main fantasy leagues that are really all I care about when it comes to fantasy football. I wanted to know what draft strategy I should use when having only one or two main drafts. Should I always go with the best available at wide receiver and running back in the first 5 to 7 rounds? Or should I take a sure bet tight end and maybe even a Cam Newton or Russell Wilson to have a weekly quarterback? What is your strategy that you take in your biggest or most important leagues? Thanks, Trevor." My strategy is fairly similar throughout. It's not like I'm advocating for a late round quarterback strategy or streaming the quarterback position, and then when it's an important league, I say, you know what? I need to have a good weekly quarterback. Guys, I practice what I preach. I stream quarterbacks. I draft them late. I usually go with a late round tight end strategy. That doesn't change if my league is more important, because all of these ideas that I've pushed forward and studied are what I've researched as optimal ideas. Moving away from those ideas would then be suboptimal. This next one says, "I don't know where you stand on kickers, but my leagues all use them. In looking at past drafts for those leagues, we've been horrendous at drafting defenses, but pretty good at drafting kickers. Is there an edge to be had in drafting a kicker? Wes." No one should be drafting defenses and kickers with the thought of using those players for the entire season, and this question kind of makes it sound like your league mates are using the same kickers over and over again. You should be streaming kickers and defenses. You play them by matchup. And yes, there is a process to selecting kickers each week. You want to look for teams who are going to score a lot of points, teams that might struggle in the red zone, and teams that should be in a positive game script. Because when those teams are leading, that means they'll be more inclined to settle for field goals instead of being overly aggressive and trying for a touchdown. This next question is from Twitter from @ShockerManor. In your latest episode, you mentioned players to draft, including Watkins, 6th round ADP, Cobb, 7th, Sanders, 8th, and Meredith, 11th. Does that mean we should go heavy running back in rounds 1 through 5? No, not necessarily. I also mentioned Rex Burkhead and Nyheim Hines as running backs to target, and I also mentioned Julio Jones as a wide receiver that you should also feel comfortable with. Burkhead and Nyheim Hines aren't early round selections, and Julio Jones is. I do find myself getting at least one running back in the first two rounds this year, but I'm not locked into a running back in the first three or four rounds type of strategy. I just saw those particular players as some of the best values in fantasy drafts this year. And the other thing too is that you shouldn't always assume you're going to get those guys. Just because you see them as valuable doesn't mean someone else in your league won't also see them as valuable. So basically what I'm saying is there are plenty of early round wide receivers that I love and that I'm more than open to drafting. This next question is from @KRMoneyFire. What's your opinion on using film to subjectively evaluate a player's talent and opportunity to predict future fantasy production? I know that I'm a numbers-oriented analyst, but it's not like I don't watch football, you guys. I watch every game each week to make sure that what I'm seeing with data matches what I'm seeing with my eyes. I think film is important, but I do believe that numbers are more important when it comes to fantasy football because fantasy football is a game about numbers. Good players can be bad in fantasy football and vice versa because situation is just as important as talent is. So the individual talent that you see on film isn't always enough. Putting it into context is absolutely vital, and a lot of times that context is easiest to understand with analytics. But one thing that kind of annoys me with the film and numbers debate is that it's not like every single player is bad analytically and then good from a film perspective. Film and numbers generally do align. A player who looks good on film is also good from a numbers standpoint. It's just that we hear about the disagreements because people aren't going to talk about the agreements as much. So to answer your question directly, I think numbers in fantasy football are more important than film. But if you're able to, you should also be using both to help with your decision making. And to be honest, I think that every player evaluation is unique in its own way. There's never a simple formula to just figure it all out. This last question says, JJ, congratulations and welcome to the #DadRunner family. Thank you. Care to describe and outline your Apex Fantasy League strategy? You always say no one cares about my fantasy team, but I think this situation is different. You said you considered Michael Thomas at the 1-2 turn, but who else was in consideration, and why did you end up selecting Gordon and Fournette over those players? Always love to hear the process in order to glean additional information. Thanks, man. Brandon. So for those of you who don't know, Apex Fantasy Leagues has hosted an expert league over the last 4 years, with this being the fifth one. And it's always one of the most difficult drafts of the season for me because you've got a group of analysts who really have unique strategies. And it's also the most wide receiver heavy draft of the year because a lot of teams go zero RB with the format starting 2 running backs, 3 wide receivers, a flex, while it's full PPR. Even though I knew this, I ended up getting Melvin Gordon and Leonard Fournette with my first two selections at the 1-2 turn. So I was in the 12 spot and I got Melvin Gordon and Leonard Fournette. It was pretty risky knowing that everyone was planning on hoarding wide receivers, but the reason I did it was because I'm still a firm believer, based on research that I've done, that stud running backs give you the biggest edge in fantasy. And to me, both Gordon and Leonard Fournette have at least some chance to break into that elite tier if things break their way. And then from there, my plan was to just pound wide receivers with the hope of hitting on 2 or 3 of them. But while I did that, given I was at the turn, I tried my best to pair upside with floor so that I'm not completely ruining my team with risky wide receivers. So at the 3-4 turn, I got Demaryius Thomas, and then I got Doug Baldwin. Thomas is a floor play in my eyes, given that his projection is fairly predictable and safe, while Doug Baldwin is risky given his knee injury. But Baldwin presents plenty of upside, and he's expected to be ready in week 1. And then I did the same thing at the 5-6 turn, getting Corey Davis as wide receiver 31 and Randall Cobb at wide receiver 32. I know there are plenty of injury question marks with Randall Cobb, but he at least should provide a safe floor if he is healthy, and then Corey Davis is the ceiling play of the two. Then at wide receiver 41, I thankfully got Cooper Kupp, who I think was one of the best value picks of the draft, at least for me. And then I also ended up getting Cam Meredith at wide receiver 51. So that was my thought process. I've got a ton of injury risk on my team right now, but I do feel pretty good that at least some of those players will pan out. But that's it for the questions. Thanks again for listening, you guys. If you have to subscribe to the Late Round Podcast, make sure you are by searching for it on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, TuneIn, and Stitcher. And don't forget to leave a rating and review on iTunes. It would be greatly, greatly appreciated. And follow me on Twitter, @LateRoundQB. Thanks, everyone. Enjoy your weekend.